this is Tom Williams. You are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This week, our interview is with Scott Westerman, who is a well-known actor in Chicago and one of our top directors, who has a major role in one of the best plays to come out in many, many years, Pulitzer Prize-winning Time of Your Life, that is in a great performance at Artistic Home. Hello, Scott.
Hello, and thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this play. This is one of the, in many experts consider this one of the 25 best American plays.
I can't argue with that. But upon first reading it and knowing that we were going to be doing it in our season, I fell in love with the language alone immediately, and I didn't quite get it. It's a very subtle play, and it's one that the rehearsal process was a wonderful exploration and almost like solving mysteries.
Yeah, it is kind of a mission because it's an ensemble piece.
It is 22 actors, 24 characters, maybe 25 characters. It's an immersive experience, and the play itself is environmental. You're in this dive bar, this honky tonk in San Francisco. And
it's 1939, right? Sort of the end of the Depression.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. With the war looming and unions starting workers starting to unionize, and there was police brutality, and there all kinds of stuff that are relevant, very relevant today. It's amazing to me how much is still going on.
Yeah.
That is explored in this play. So it's a pretty important play, and Saroyan touching on that stuff then, you can only imagine how groundbreaking it was at that time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it was part of that group. There was a lot of, I think he was at least a semi-socialist. He wasn't as much of a socialist, I don't think, as Odets and some of the other contemporaries, but it's in that vein.
Sure. He doesn't come in and hit you over the head. He's not putting out a political message. He's not hitting you overhead with a point that he's trying to make. He lays out a landscape that these things are happening in this world, and it's up to you, with the audience member, to have your feelings about it, to have your feelings about the war coming on, and.
But it's as much a slice of life, but it also, it has its down moments, but it's not. It's a hopeful play, isn't it?
I think it's very hopeful. I mean, after performing it, I can't. It's hard to shake the melancholy that is riding underneath this entire play. That being said, it's hilarious and it's fun to do, and it's inspiring and filled with hope.
You have one of the two anchor roles. There's Joe, who sits at a table drinking champagne, and Nick, the bartender. They're the two anchors of the show.
Yeah, sure.
Who would you say is Sarayan's mouthpiece? Is it Nick? Here's a joke.
Well, that's an interesting question. I would argue that it's Saroyan. The Saroyan is using Joe as a mouthpiece more than anybody else, but I think he uses everybody. I think every one of these characters has some of his sentiments coming through. There's McCarthy, who's on stage for 10 minutes, played by Mark Pracht brilliantly.
And yeah, he's a great actor.
And
yeah,
some of the stuff that he says is just, it has to be straight out of Saroyan's brain, you know. And but in the writing of this play, he was commissioned and offered. Saroyan was offered a bunch of money to write this play. He was commissioned to do it.
Oh, what's he commissioned? Oh, I didn't know
so
that.
So he took time away from his career and what he was doing.
He was writing mostly novels at the time.
Right. He just went and he sat in bars and watched people and interviewed people and wrote this play. That I think that's kind of what his process was in doing this. And these are the things that he found. This play is bits and pieces.
Tell us about Joe, because Joe is one of more, I think, one of the more interesting characters in American drama.
He's fascinating. Yeah. He is a mystery, and I think he's supposed to be, like, in analyzing the script and preparing for the role. You know, you start, an actor starts with the given circumstances, what this character says and what people say about him, only what's in the script. And if I take just those clues, there's not a ton to go on. There's just bits and pieces. It's a mystery, and I think that's what I have to start with, and then make it as specific as I can myself. So
yeah,
that
how did you interpret it? Because he is unique. He's a philanthropist in a certain way, right?
Yeah, he's got a dark past. Certainly has to have a dark past. He talks about that, and he talks about how he has hurt people to get where he is financially. And
do you think he meant that literally, or just as a businessman? You know, that they tend to make money, they tend to hurt people. What do you think?
I want to play it with the strongest choice possible, so I'm taking it literally that he has hurt people. And then when people say things like, or talk about other people that are bad, like, for instance, Nick, the bartender, talks about Blick, this evil character that comes in and wants to shut down the bar.
Vice cop, yeah.
He talks about him. He says he made one of the girls want to commit suicide. And for me to hear that and ingest that and apply that to my own character and make and make myself feel worse, like, the strongest choice is that maybe I've caused people to want to commit suicide in my past, you know, and those are the kinds of things, like, little.
So he's kind of guilt driven to a certain extent.
I think he feels very guilty. I think he's trying to make up for something in this play.
And he's generous with cash, right?
Very generous. He's helping people. There's kind of this omniscient, omnipotent, sitting back watching, but very generous and giving, and seems to really care about these denizens that fill this honky tonk.
Including the Tom, right? The sort of simpleton.
Oh, Tom. Yeah, that character is really wonderful. Innocent and, the essence of innocence, and there's this relationship that he has with Tom, that Tom is kind of his surrogate. There's something about in the play, like, there's all these clues about Joe not being able to walk, not being able to dance, not being able, and perhaps would even love to dance with Kitty when she asks him, dance with me, just hold me in your arms, dance with me. And he says, I never learned to dance. I can't dance. I'm sorry. I'm very fond of you. I can't dance. I wish to God I could. And then Tom comes in and he tells Tom to dance with her. So there's this kind of surrogate. I mean, he tells Tom to go get him his chewing gum. Go get me this. Go get me a revolver. Go get me this. Go dance with her. There's this way that Tom is doing the things that Joe can't for himself. There's an impotence about Joe. And I think that's something, I mean, I sit in the same chair for 90 more than 90% of the play.
And you're on stage probably as much as anybody, right?
I'd say so, yeah. Yeah. Maybe Nick is on stage more.
Well, he leaves for a while too. Yeah, it's pretty close between the two of them.
It's very Shakespearean in structure, in that I'm on stage the whole time, and then I leave for Act Four, and then come back for Act Five. It's a five act play, so I have that fourth act.
Tell
break.
Us about some of the colorful customers that come in. You got some really unique people.
We do. There's Willie the pinball wizard. He comes in and he's a pinball maniac, the script Saroyan calls him in the script. And he comes in and he just buys a beer and he's on his way out and then sees the pinball machine and is lured to it, drawn to it. He has to go and put a nickel in the slot and play. And he's there playing the pinball machine.
Yeah, a lot of the plays.
For most of the play. And then Saroyan brilliantly has him on stage the whole time. He's ambiance. You hear the pinball. I mean, our props are so wonderful and specific and realistic, and you hear that ball rolling around in there. You hear him popping it every once in a while, and And then suddenly he turns around and he has this big speech. He wins the game and he has this big speech. And the stuff that he says, and it comes out of nowhere. It's a big surprise. And then you got Arab that sits at the bar the whole time and then suddenly plays the most beautiful harmonica you could ever imagine.
And he has what's the comment he makes?
No foundation.
No, he says it over and over
again. No foundation all the way down the line. This side, that side. And they're just so surprising, and unexpected things come out of their mouths. And
you got the dancer kid.
Harry comes in wanting a job. He wants to be a comedian. He wants to be a dancer, a hoofer, and Nick, this benevolent bar owner, is so embracing and
he's a good guy,
wonderful.
Isn't he? Yeah, he tries to help everybody, doesn't he?
You're not funny, but I'll give you a job. He helps people out. And then there's Wesley, who comes in and is fainting. He wants to work for some money. He wants to help in the kitchen or something like that. And then suddenly is drawn to the piano and starts playing beautifully. And
sounds like Chopin at the beginning, I'm not sure. or some of his songs to me like ragtime that he was playing.
Maybe. Yeah. I'm not even sure.
I think it was ragtime that we played over and over again.
I wouldn't know. Joe Sirkwa, the sound designer, did a great job setting up the
whole thing, the transforming the storefront theater into this dive bar. I mean, it
using you our actual
in, you could go in for
window.
Business. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Our opening night party was in the bar. You know, we just, you know, put the champagne out and the wine out there on the bar, and that's where we hung out.
So tell us some of the deep meanings of this. Why people should come see this play, other than seeing some of the best ensemble acting of a terrific script.
Oh, thank you. That's a huge reason. And that's what makes it fun for me, is that there are 21 other actors that my job is to be available and sit there and ingest and listen to
react to everything. Yeah.
Everything they do. And it's kind of like a, you know, in fights in Western, there's a stage combat or a fist fight in a Western, there's always this character that's the pointer that's watching what the audience should watch and reacting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that Kathy Scambiaterra and Kevin Hagen, the set designer, in their ground plan have put me downstage almost with the same perspective and view of the stage that the audience has.
Yeah, you're only a couple feet away.
So, you know, hopefully I'm helping to draw the eye to where it needs to go, because there's a lot of activity going on with 22 actors and
nobody upstaged anybody, which I like. That's good discipline.
That's wonderful.
You know, it could very easily during, you know, one of your scenes, the pinball guy trying to steal it or you know, by doing other things. But the discipline was there.
Oh, great.
How about the kid, the paper boy? He had a terrific scene.
Declan Collins. He's got a beautiful voice, doesn't he?
Yeah.
he's great. That character comes in and just wants to sell papers and is getting kind of old to be selling papers and asks if you could use a good lyric tenor to Nick, and Nick gives him a shot and tells him to come back in a year, but he sings this beautiful song.
Yeah, he did a good job with it.
Perfect,
that's tough to do, yeah.
Absolutely. And it's at a moment when hope seems to be lost and there's a dark moment, and he comes in and brightens everything and kind of pulls my character Joe out of a slump. There's a horrible thing that happens right before that, and then he starts singing and draws me right back out.
And then what about the Kit Carson? and a terrific actor playing over there.
Frank Nall, yes, he is fantastic. And it's almost like William Saroyan reached 75 years into the future and wrote something for Frank Nall. He's able to,
yeah,
to just command
really, it's just, yeah.
Speech after speech of these stories, and they're so alive. And I think that's something interesting about that character. Kit Carson is telling these stories, which you don't know whether to believe or not.
After a while, you realize, because he's going way back he would have been 100 and some years old, right? But yeah, for earlier on, the first few, you don't know if they're true or not.
You don't know if they're true or not, and then they get more and more out there, and you're like, no, there's no way they're true. But then at the very end of the play, I don't want to give anything away, he tells a story that you know is true, and he tells it in the same style that he's told every other story.
Yeah.
And you start to wonder.
Yeah.
But the difference, the dichotomy, the juxtaposition between Kit Carson's character and my character, Joe. Joe, as I've said before, he's impotent. He's unable to get up and move. He's unable to live his own life and do some of the things. So he's got surrogates. He's got people doing things for him. And Kit Carson is up and moving. Like Frank plays him very actively with a lot of activity and a lot of movement and blocking and these stories of doing this and doing that and protecting people and fighting and guns and this and that. And I think that it's something that it's a character that comes in and inspires Joe. Because in the very next scene, I'm ready to stand up. I'm ready to
do
something.
He does get you going, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's something about that I think is just wonderful structurally in the play.
How do you get up for this every night?
How do I get up for it?
For this?
How do I prepare?
Yeah, because you've got one of the anchor roles. I mean, a lot of it hinges on you and Nick.
Sure. Well, I mean, I do probably what any actor does. I need to prepare and warm up and know my lines. And I mean, the actor's job is a tough thing, but the biggest job is to do what we have to do to be available, emotionally, physically, vocally, intellectually available to the character and to those that we are playing with, our collaborators. And this play, these other 21 actors are going out and doing amazing things, and I get to just ingest and watch people and let them affect me. And I use these words, Saroyan's words, he's a beast, I just want to stay out of his way.
He no wasted dialogue. That generation of writers, every one of them, right? You never have to edit a word.
Important, and it's all there. And I get to say those words. I go out there and live on the stage and try to be available to those I'm playing with.
You got Jeff recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I got a feeling there might be an award or two somewhere along the line for this show.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, never know. There's a lot of great competition, but it is a great production. So give us a little commercial for it. Where, when, and so forth?
Oh, we play Thursdays at 7:30, Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m., and Sundays at 3 p.m. for the next 6 weeks until October 25th. We're at the Artistic Home at
Grand and Noble, I think. 1376
West Grand.
Why is it actors never know what the address is? But you find your way there each time.
We sure do. We just go to the building and do our jobs. 1376 West Grand, that's correct. And we hope some people come out and see us.
I hope you got to get there, too. So let's talk about one of the best productions of the Scottish play that you did last year. It was really amazing. Tell us about how you dealt with it. I mean, the set was different. Remember, we talked earlier about how vocally you did it. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Well, this play, I love that play, Macbeth, and I love Shakespeare, and I love language, and going into doing this play, you know, I find out I'm going to be directing it about 7 or 8 months before rehearsal started, and I start thinking about how we want to approach it, and at about the same time, I was digging into the script and looking at what I wanted to do. My wife, Abby Jeanney, who is a published writer, was commissioned by WBEZ to write a story for their After Water project. And they basically took journalists and scientists and artists, writers, and put them together to imagine a world in 100 years if some steps are not taken to save
water shortages,
to save our most natural
pollution.
Yeah. So she wrote this story, and when I read it, I was stunned. And I started looking at her research and what I was doing, and the references to water in Macbeth were I couldn't deny them.
Yeah, and you don't realize it until your production made all of us think about that. We were talking about it afterward, about the water references. Yeah,
so imagine a world where there's too much water, or an area of the city where there's too much water and none of it's any good, and it's toxic, in fact. And so that's how I approached the play, and we started working with designers, and we wanted to create the level where the humans were, like, human beings, the Thanes and whoever, were having to traverse these gaps in the land where they're able to
walk. The runways and things.
And underneath was the water, this toxic water. And so we did that with light and haze and the witches and the beings.
It's amazing for a small intimate theater what you guys came up with. It was really impressive.
It was really fun to do. It was a really interesting concept to play with. And then I got 14 fantastic actors who did their work, and I had a great assistant director and text coach, Chris Prentice, who is
I know Chris. Yeah, Chris was at Stratford for a couple of years.
Yeah,
Chris is a real smart kid.
He's a fantastic classical actor himself. Yeah. So between the two of us, having our classical backgrounds, I have an MFA in classical acting from the Shakespeare Theater in D.C. and George Washington University. So we just took what we knew, and we helped this cast get to a place where the language was clear.
And, yeah, it was very clear.
And not pushed. And we told, from the first time we got up and started working with the actors, we just told them to talk to each other. You know what you're saying, just talk to each other. Don't feel the need to perform or project. And that brought the levels down and the intimacy of this space to a really cool place.
John Mossman, he whispered to a point where everybody was... could hear him, but we were leaning forward, and we were so engaged. You could see everybody was so engaged. He said he noticed it too. It was almost scary how they were with him. Yeah.
And he's talking to the audience. There's a self. There's this direct address where he's talking to us and almost whispering to us, and we want to be. And it helps us to go along with him on this journey.
It sure does. Yeah.
And imagine ourselves.
So that was conscious on your part to get them to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean. John
took it to a great place, and they had the technical ability
he's
got
a bunch
to
of Shakespeare,
do that.
So yeah, he knows what he's talking.
Yeah, projecting is more than just volume. Projecting is all the aspects of speech, and it's not just how loud you talk; it's how clear you are and your diction. And
well, I hope every director and actor in town listens to it. It's so true. Because I hear it all the time. You know, you hear it either they're screaming it or they're mumbling so bad you don't know what they're saying. And there's that certain balance, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Our bodies are amazing. They involuntarily take in the exact amount of breath that is needed for a thought. That's how we as human beings, we get an impulse to say a thought, and our bodies take in the exact amount of breath needed for that thought. And so as actors, we have to do that with characters. We have to find a way to do that with characters. Actors tend to take in too much breath, and then it sounds all blowhard, to be or not to be. And then you have all this breath left over, and that's not how human speech really is.
That's true. But you reached a level with that production.
Thank you.
How well did that show do? Because I was in our opening night, and I thought it was fantastic.
It did very well. We sold a lot of tickets. It was going great. We extended once and would have extended again, but we had such talented actors and people that, you know, they were booked after that, and we weren't able to keep
going. Why didn't we extend it? That's good.
I think we could have extended again had everybody been available. I think we wanted to, and it was selling really well. And
sound like you're proud of that show.
I'm very proud of it. I couldn't be more proud of that. That was a lot of work, and it paid off, and it was worth it because we made
sure
something.
It was some terrific art, and it showed that not all the good Shakespeare happens at Chicago Shakespeare or at Court or at Writers. You guys are capable of that. Are you going to do more Shakespeare?
I hope. I'm pitching it.
All right. Which one would you want to do?
Well, the three that I've been pitching are Hamlet,
okay.
The Winter's Tale,
okay.
And Twelfth Night. Those are the three that I'd like to do next.
Who would you see playing Hamlet?
Julian Hester.
Interesting. He's good. So you want a younger?
I think he's got the ability.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he does too. Yeah. That would be interesting casting. Yeah. I think that's going to happen.
I don't know. You'll have to ask Kathy Scambiatera about that one.
Yeah, okay. Well, she's pretty open to it, right? It would, Time of Your Life was her passion, right? That was that, yeah.
Yeah,
she told
yeah.
me she was pushing it.
We were looking at the season, and she was excited to direct this play, and that's important. You know, if she's excited, we're excited, and she's such a great leader, and she's somebody that we can all get behind.
All right, you've got quite an acting resume. Tell me some of the shows that you've been in that you're proud of. Every actor has their ones that, you know.
Well, one of my favorite to do was Job Opportunity. It's by Ralph Concepcion, and Michael Fosberg and I produced it and did it in an actual car driving around the streets of Chicago.
Is that
and
right?
The audience sat in the back seat. And
how many could you get in, two or three?
We had three or four,
okay.
Usually. As many seatbelts as we could fit. You know, and it was kind of rock and roll. We were able to sell our tickets through Mercury and then the box office at Bailiwick. We used those two box offices so that people could pay with a credit card. Fosberg would pick them up, and then once they got in the car, he would give them the opening speech to say, once I get in the car, I'm in character and your fly's on the wall. And it was this immersive experience where they were sitting in the back seat, so intimate, and I'm sitting in the passenger seat, we have dialogue, and if you can imagine, if the traffic was heavy one night or something happened in the city, we had to react to it. I mean, that was, so we had the script, but we also had to be ready to improvise at any moment, and there's no more trust with another actor that I've ever had in my life than with Michael Fosberg, because we were just ready to dive in and follow each other wherever we had to
go. Sounds like you need to bring that back.
I would love to. I would love to. It was a really fun experience. Yeah, there was that. I enjoyed doing Lifeline Theater's Lord of the Rings. I played Sam Gamgee in the Return of the King, their third one.
Yeah.
And that was a really fun experience. Ned Moschel directed it. It was, yeah. You know, that show was on crack. It was awesome. It was
yeah,
so much fun.
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's tons.
What are some of the roles you're dying to do that you haven't done yet?
I want somebody to adapt Henderson, The Rain King by Saul Bellow, and I want to play Henderson.
Okay.
That's a role.
Got anybody? Have you talked anybody into doing it yet?
Well, let's call Rob Kozlarik. He's a great adapter.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, Rob would be good for it. Yeah,
yeah, wouldn't he?
Okay.
Maybe Chris Hainsworth, one of those guys.
Okay, the Lifeline. Well, Life.
That's what they do.
Nobody, and they do a great job.
If they can get Saul Bellow to let him do it, that'd be fun.
He's still around, huh?
I don't know. Maybe, or his estate. I don't. I honestly don't know. I don't either.
I think he's got to be an old man if he's around.
I haven't seen a Facebook post that he passed.
I haven't either. Yeah, that would have been all over.
Right?
Okay, that's...
But, you know, most of the Shakespeare's, I still would love to play Iago. I'd love to... do Richard. I'd love to.
Richard III?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I could see him doing that.
And then any Chekhov role. I said early in my career I wanted to play all the Chekhov men. I've played Konstantin and Trofimov.
Let's go back and do it. I'm getting sick of these adaptations of it. I'm not a fan. I'm a purist. It's just like Gilbert and Sullivan. Do Gilbert and Sullivan.
Well, the third show on the Artistic Home season is The Seagull.
Is it?
It is. Cody Essel's going to direct it. He's going
to
direct
it. He's a good young director, the kid, yeah.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's good. I haven't seen, you know, you got to have an Ibsen and you got to have a Chekhov every once in a while just to keep the blood flowing, right?
Absolutely. I love taking these classics and I love the new work. Our next play I'm directing is called Interrogation.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Tell us about
it. It's Interrogation. It's a new play that we actually did in development with ensemble members at the Artistic Home. Scott Waldman, who is amazing, came in and worked with us and wrote this script and these characters based on ensemble members, and I helped facilitate that, and we worked for a year, and we have a script that we're really excited to do, and that'll be our show opening early February, I think February 12th, something like that. We're opening right around there.
Well, I love new shows. You know, I love the old ones, but you get tired of, you know, about the 100th time.
Yeah.
So this
is our big premiere of the season. We're excited to do
it. Last question I always ask, what advice would you give to young actors and young directors starting out?
Work. Do it. And work begets work, and if you go into every experience open to learn and grow from it and collaborate with other people.
Let's say someone is interested in acting and interested in directing. Where would you steer them? Where, in what order would you? Do you have to be a good actor to be a good director? Or?
No, I don't know. I think every artist is different. I mean, I have found a way that acting and directing and teaching have all fed each other. And I mean, I think I started out as an actor, and then I started directing. I've written plays, and
oh, I didn't know you were a playwright also.
Yeah. I don't do that as much. I work more with ensembles and devised work, and I teach devised work at the Chicago High School for the Arts.
Oh, okay, that's good.
I'm the assistant to the head of the theater department at the Chicago High School for the Arts, and I teach acting and scene study and voice and speech. And
you also teach at the Artistic Home, too.
I teach classical acting at the Artistic Home, and so I work with these students. And I think training is extremely important for actors. And if you embrace the training and you get to a place where you do it, but it's an immersive. You can't learn theater through books. Books help, but you can't learn it through books. You got to learn it by doing it.
It's an apprenticeship, isn't it? You got to get out and do it.
And it's a collaborative art form, so it's about working with people. And the more you can become available to an ensemble, available to each other, your scene partner, or whatever, that's your job. That's the job of the actor and theater artisan all around. And the show I'm doing right now, 22 actors, a director, designers, assistant director, RJ Coleman, he's great. We're all a collaborative collective, and we're making something that we can collectively be proud of.
And you sure are making it. Folks, make sure you go see Time of Your Life. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Tom.
Go see a play this week.